formally articulated a statement of its core purpose. Yet, from our observations, Nike has a powerful core purpose that permeates the entire organization: to experience the emotion of competition, winning, and crushing competitors. Nike has a campus that seems more like a shrine to the competitive spirit than a corporate office complex. Giant photos of Nike heroes cover the walls. Bronze plaques of Nike athletes hang along the Nike Walk of Fame. Statues of Nike athletes stand alongside the running track that rings the campus. And buildings are named after champions like Olympic marathon champion Joan Benoit, basketball superstar Michael Jordan, and tennis player John McEnroe. Nike people who do not feel stimulated by the competitive spirit and the urge to be ferocious simply don't last long in the culture. Even the company's name, Nike is the Greek goddess of victory, reflects a sense of competition. Thus, although Nike hasn't formally articulated its purpose, it clearly has a strong one. You should therefore focus on getting the content right, on capturing the essence of the core values and purpose, not on wordsmithing the perfect statements to be etched in stone. The point is not to create a perfect statement, but to gain a deep understanding of your organization's core values and purpose, which can then be expressed in a multitude of ways. In fact, once the core has been identified, we like to suggest that every manager generate his or her own statement of the core values and purpose to share with his or her people. Once you're clear about the core ideology, you should feel free to change absolutely anything that is not part of the core ideology. You also must determine what type of progress you want to stimulate, which brings us to the second component of the vision framework. Envisioned future. Envisioned future, the second primary component of the vision framework, consists of two parts: a 10 to 30 year audacious goal, or BHAG, and vivid descriptions of what it will be like when the organization achieves the BHAG. We selected the phrase envisioned future, recognizing that it contains a paradox. On the one hand, it conveys a sense of concreteness, something vivid and real. You can see it, touch it, feel it. On the other hand, it portrays a time yet unrealized, a dream, hope, or aspiration. Vision level BHAG. We found in our research that visionary companies often use bold missions, or what we prefer to call BHAGs. This is short for big, hairy, audacious goals, as a powerful way to stimulate progress. All companies have goals, but there is a difference between merely having a goal and becoming committed to a huge, daunting challenge like climbing a big mountain. A true BHAG is clear and compelling and serves as a unifying focal point of effort and acts as a catalyst for team spirit. It has a clear finish line so the organization can know when it has achieved the goal. People like to shoot for finish lines. A BHAG engages people. It reaches out and grabs them in the gut. It is tangible, energizing, highly focused. People get it right away. It takes little or no explanation. When an expedition sets out to climb Mount Everest, it doesn't need a 3-page mission statement to explain what Mount Everest is. Most corporate statements we've seen do little to provoke forward movement because they do not contain the powerful mechanism of a BHAG. In creating such a vision-level BHAG, we suggest thinking about the following four categories: target, common enemy, role model, or internal transformation. Target BHAGs can be quantitative or qualitative. For example, becoming a $125 billion company by the year 2000. This was Walmart's BHAG in 1990. Democratize the automobile. This was Ford's BHAG in the early 1900s. Common enemy BHAGs involve focusing on beating a common enemy, a David versus Goliath BHAG. For example, crush Adidas. This was Nike's BHAG in the 1960s. Yamaha wo Tsubusu. We will crush, squash, slaughter Yamaha. This was Honda's BHAG in the 1970s. Role model BHAGs are particularly effective for up-and-coming organizations with bright prospects. For example, become the Nike of the cycling industry. This was Giro Sport Design's BHAG in 1986. Become the Harvard of the West. This was Stanford University's BHAG in the 1940s. Internal transformation BHAGs tend to be effective in old or large organizations in need of internal transformation. For example, become number one or number two in every market we serve and revolutionize this company to have the strengths of a big company combined with the leanness and agility of a small company. This was General Electric's BHAG in the 1980s. Vivid descriptions. Vivid description, the second component of Envision Future, is a vibrant, engaging, and specific description of what it will be like to achieve the BHAG. Think of it as translating the vision from words into pictures, of creating an image that people can carry around in their heads. We call this painting a picture with your words. For example, Henry Ford brought to life the BHAG to democratize the automobile with a vivid description, "I will build a motor car for the great multitude. It will be so low in price that no man making a good salary will be unable to own one, and enjoy with his family the blessing of hours of pleasure in God's great open spaces. When I'm through, everybody will be able to afford one, and everyone will have one. The horse will have disappeared from our highways. The automobile will be taken for granted, and we will give a large number of men employment at good wages." Passion, emotion, and conviction are essential parts of the vivid description. Some managers are uncomfortable with expressing emotion about their dreams, but it's the passion and emotion that will attract and motivate others. Winston Churchill understood this when he described the BHAG facing Great Britain in 1940. He didn't just say, "Beat Hitler." He said, "Hitler knows he will have to break us on this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, the whole world, including the United States, including all we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, 'This was their finest hour.'" Whereas identifying core ideology is a discovery process, setting the envisioned future is a creative process. As such, we find that executives often have a great deal of difficulty coming up with an exciting BHAG. They want to analyze their way into the future. We found, therefore, that some executives make more progress by starting first with a vivid description and backing from there into the BHAG. This approach involves starting with questions like, "We're sitting here in 20 years. What would we love to see? What would this company look like? What would it feel like to employees? What would it have achieved? If someone wrote an article for a major business magazine about this company in 20 years, what would it say?" It makes no sense to analyze whether an envisioned future is the right one. With a creation, and the task is to create a future, not to predict the future, there can be no right answer. Did Beethoven create the right Ninth Symphony? Did Shakespeare create the right Hamlet? We can't answer these questions. They're nonsense. The essential questions about the envisioned future involve such questions as, does it get our juices flowing? Do we find it stimulating? Does it stimulate forward momentum? Does it get people going? To create an effective envisioned future requires a certain level of unreasonable confidence and commitment. Keep in mind that a BHAG is not just a goal. It's a big, hairy, audacious goal. Of course, it's not just the audacity of the goal, but also the level of commitment to the goal. Boeing didn't just envision a future dominated by its commercial jets. It bet the company on the 707. Nike people didn't just talk about the idea of crushing Adidas. They went on a crusade to fulfill the dream. Indeed, the envisioned future should produce a bit of the gulp factor. When it dawns on people what it will take to achieve the goal and the level of commitment to the goal, there should be an almost audible gulp. Putting it all together. To further illustrate the vision framework, we give an example of all the elements fitting together into a complete vision. Sony is a small entrepreneurial company in the 1950s. Sony's core ideology. First, its core values. Elevation of the Japanese national culture and status. Being a pioneer, not following others, but doing the impossible. Respect and encouragement of individual ability and creativity. Second, its purpose. To experience the sheer joy of innovation and the application of technology for the benefit and pleasure of the general public. Sony's envisioned future. First, its BHAG. Become the company most known for changing the worldwide image of Japanese products as being of poor quality. Second, its vivid description. We will create the products that become pervasive around the world. We will be the first Japanese company to go into the American market and distribute directly. We will succeed with innovations like the transistor radio that American companies failed at. 50 years from now, our brand name will be as well known as any on earth and will signify innovation and quality that rivals the most innovative companies anywhere. Made in Japan will mean something fine, not shoddy. And they achieved it. Finally, in thinking about your vision, beware the we've arrived syndrome, a complacent lethargy that arises once an organization has achieved a BHAG and fails to replace it with another. NASA suffered from the we've arrived syndrome after the successful moon landings. After you've landed on the moon, what do you do for an encore? Ford suffered from the syndrome when, after it succeeded in democratizing the automobile, it failed to set a new goal of equal significance and gave GM the opportunity to jump ahead in the 1930s. A BHAG only helps an organization so long as it hasn't yet been achieved. In our work with companies, we frequently hear executives say, "It's just not as exciting around here as it used to be. We seem to have lost our momentum." Usually, this signals that the organization has climbed one mountain and not yet picked a new mountain to climb. It's in the alignment, not the words. It's become fashionable in recent decades for companies to spend countless hours and sums of money drafting elegant vision statements, value statements, mission statements, purpose statements, aspiration statements, objective statements, and so on. Such pronouncements are all fine and good. Indeed, they can be quite useful, but they're not the essence of a visionary company. Just because a company has a vision statement in no way guarantees that it will become a visionary company. If you walk away from this book thinking that the most essential step in building a visionary company is to write a statement, then you will have missed the whole point. A statement might be a good first step, but it is only a first step. The essence of a visionary company comes in the translation of its core ideology and its own unique drive for progress into the very fabric of the organization. Into goals, strategies, tactics, policies, processes, cultural practices, management behaviors, building layouts, pay systems, accounting systems, job design, into everything that the company does. A visionary company creates a total environment that envelops employees, bombarding them with a set of signals so consistent and mutually reinforcing that it's virtually impossible to misunderstand the core values and purpose. In the late 1920s, George W. Merck formulated the backbone of Merck's vision, building upon core values of integrity, contribution to society, responsibility to customers and employees, and the unequivocal pursuit of quality and excellence. He envisioned Merck as a world-class company that benefits humanity through innovative contributions to medicine. At the 1933 opening of the Merck Research Laboratory, he said, "We believe that research work carried on with patience and persistence will bring to industry and commerce new life, and we have faith that in this new laboratory, with the tools we have supplied, science will be advanced, knowledge increased, and human life will win ever a greater freedom from suffering and disease. We pledge our every aid that this enterprise shall merit the faith we have in it. Let your light so shine that those who seek the truth, that those who toil that this world may be a better place to live in, that those who hold aloft the torch of science and knowledge through these social and economic dark ages shall take new courage and feel their hands supported." We're certainly impressed with George Merck's visionary pronouncement, especially given that he spoke these words over 60 years ago, long before vision statements became popular. But his words and sentiments alone, as inspiring and impressive as they are, do not, indeed could not, make Merck a visionary company. The truly outstanding thing about Merck is how consistently it has aligned itself with the core ideology and the type of progress envisioned by George Merck. In our original 1994 edition of Built to Last, we examined the alignment mechanisms at work in Merck and came away with quite a sizable list. For example, the company didn't just create a standard industrial R&D lab. Instead, it set the BHAG of creating a research capability so outstanding that it could talk on equal terms with universities and research institutes. In fact, Merck explicitly designed the research laboratories to have an academic atmosphere and appearance, to look so much like a college that it quickly became known as the Merck campus. Furthermore, instead of keeping its pure research behind locked doors, Merck encouraged its research scientists to publish in scientific journals, a key move that attracted many a top scientist. It also encouraged its researchers to collaborate with scientists at academic and non-competing industrial research laboratories outside of Merck, an unusual step that improved the quality of their published work. The company recruited prominent academic scientists to serve on the board of directors and created a dual career track that allowed scientists to pass up promotions into management without financial penalty. Merck even went so far as to list the scientific publications of its researchers in recruiting materials, much as an academic institution lists the publications of its faculty. As one scientist summed up, Merck is like MIT or Harvard or any other academic institution with an outstanding reputation for research. You have to want to do your science intensely. To further encourage scientific exploration and experimentation, Merck gave research scientists the greatest possible latitude and scope in pursuing their investigations, the utmost freedom to follow promising leads, no matter how unrelated to practical returns. Merck prohibited marketing input into the pure research process until products had well entered the developmental stage. As former CEO P. Roy Vagelos put it, "We keep basic research exclusively in the hands of research. We keep marketing out of the way until products are being tested on humans. We don't want concerns about market potential to get in the way of basic scientific exploration and experimentation that can lead to big breakthroughs." Along the way, Merck added other practices that, although unconventional, make perfect sense at Merck. For instance, Merck explicitly rejected budgets as a planning or control tool in R&D. It created new product project teams and explicitly did not give them a budget. Instead, team leaders, or champions, had to persuade people from a variety of disciplines to join the team and to commit their resources to the project. This project created a survival of the fittest selection process, where the best projects attracted resources and the weakest perished. Merck also has a long historical track record of being well-aligned with its ideology of corporate responsibility. A lot of companies talk about corporate responsibility, equal opportunity, and other such lofty ideals. But how many of these companies were one of the first to donate to the United Negro College Fund, as Merck did in 1944? How many were the first in the industry to establish an Office of Minority Affairs, as Merck did in the 1960s? How many companies in the 1970s required that all senior executives include affirmative action goals in their annual objectives and tied them to bonuses, stock options, ratings, and merit increases? How many were recognized by the National Organization for Women for their vigorous programs to recruit, develop, and promote women and minorities? How many were selected by Black Enterprise and Working Mother as one of the best places for women and minorities to work in America? How many large industrial companies put in place a woman as a chief financial officer? How many companies would have brought streptomycin to Japan at no profit to eliminate a serious outbreak of tuberculosis after the end of World War II? How many companies would have made the decision to develop Mectazan to cure river blindness and wind up giving it away? Merck consistently reinforced its core ideology, decade after decade, day after day, in shareholder reports, in recruiting materials, in employee manuals, in self-published books, in historical videos, in executive speeches, in orientation seminars, in articles for outside magazines and journals, and in a myriad of internal magazines and newsletters. When we ask Merck to send us any documents that might describe its values and purpose, Merck provided us with no fewer than 85 distinct items, some dating back to the turn of the century. As Jeffrey L. Sturcio, Merck's Director of Science and Technology Policy, summed up, "I used to work at another major American corporation before coming to Merck. The basic difference I see between the two companies is rhetoric versus reality. The other companies touted values and visions and all the rest, but there was a big difference between rhetoric and reality. At Merck, there is no difference. We applaud if you go off-site to discuss your corporate ideology, but never forget that taking such steps do not in themselves make a visionary company. You never reach final success. You have to work at it constantly. Here are some guideposts. First, paint the whole picture. Visionary companies do not rely on any one program, strategy, tactic, mechanism, cultural norm, symbolic gesture, or CEO speech to preserve the core and stimulate progress. It's the remarkable comprehensiveness and consistency over time that counts. It's the nearly overwhelming set of signals and actions, signals to continually reinforce the core ideology and to stimulate progress that lead to a visionary company. A visionary company is like a great work of art. Think of Michelangelo's scenes from Genesis on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel or his statue of David. Think of a great and enduring novel like Huckleberry Finn or Crime and Punishment. Think of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or Shakespeare's Henry V. Think of a beautifully designed building like the masterpieces of Frank Lloyd Wright or Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. You can't point to any one single item that makes the whole thing work. It's the entire work, all the pieces working together to create an overall effect. That leads to enduring greatness. And it's not just the big pieces, but also the itty-bitty details, the turn of phrase, the change in pace at just the right moment, the perfect off-center placement of a window, a subtle expression sculpted into the eyes. As a great architect Mies van der Rohe put it, God is in the details. Second, sweat the small stuff. People don't work day-to-day in the big picture. They work in the nitty-gritty details of their company and its business. Not that the big picture is irrelevant, but it's the little things that make a big impression that send powerful signals. Little things, like business cards for salespeople at Nordstrom to send the signal, we want you to be a sales professional. Little things, like Walmart giving employees at the lowest level complete departmental financial reports to send the signal, you are a partner in the company, and we want you to run your department as your own little business. Little things like allowing key divisions at Johnson & Johnson to put their own logos on the products and leave off the J&J logo to send the signal, we want you to operate with the psychology of autonomous entrepreneurial business units. Little things like Philip Morris sending employees home with a box of cigarettes along with their paycheck to send the signal, we're proud of our product, no matter what the Surgeon General says. Social cognitive research shows that individuals pick up on all the signals in their work environment, big and small, as cues for how they should behave. People notice little things. People want to believe in their company's vision, but will be ever watchful for the tiny inconsistencies that allow them to say, aha, see, there you go. I knew management was just blowing smoke. They don't really believe their own rhetoric. Third, cluster, don't shotgun. Visionary companies don't put in place any random set of mechanisms or processes. They put in place pieces that reinforce each other, clustered together to deliver a powerful combined punch. They search for synergy and linkages. Notice the clustering at Merck, recruiting of top scientists, reinforced by allowing them to publish, reinforced by allowing them to collaborate with outside scientists, reinforced by the Merck campus, reinforced by the dual career track, and so on. Fourth, swim in your own current, even if you swim against the tide. Alignment means being guided first and foremost by one's own internal compass, not the standards, practices, conventions, forces, trends, fads, fashions, and buzzwords of the outer world. Not that you should ignore reality, quite the contrary, but your company's own self-defined ideology and ambitions should guide all of the dealings with reality. If done right, you will likely astonish competitors, journalists, business professors, and others with the idiosyncratic practices and strategies that, however unusual, make perfect sense for your company. Johnson & Johnson, for example, made the decision to place its new headquarters right smack in the middle of blighted New Brunswick, New Jersey, in the 1970s, not because it made the best business sense, it didn't, but because it made the most sense in the context of the J&J credo. Boeing held itself to safety standards in designing its aircraft that far exceeded its competitors, not because the market demanded it, but because Boeing's ideology demanded it. 3M rejected the conventional business wisdom that a small growing company should concentrate on one line of business. A focus strategy simply didn't fit with the type of innovative company 3Mers wanted to build. The point here is not that the visionary companies pursue good practices and other companies pursue bad practices, good or bad puts the wrong frame on it. The real question to ask is not, is this practice good, but is this practice appropriate for us? Does it fit with our ideology and ambitions? Fifth, obliterate inconsistencies. If you look around your company right now, you can probably put your finger on at least a dozen specific items inconsistent with its core ideology or that impede progress, inappropriate practices that have somehow crept through the woodwork. Does your incentive system reward behaviors inconsistent with your core values? Does the organization structure get in the way of progress? Do goals and strategies drive the company away from its basic purpose? Do corporate policies inhibit change and improvement? Does the office and building layout stifle progress? Does the BHAG you've set require behavior inconsistent with the core values? Attaining alignment is not just a process of adding new things. It is also a never-ending process of identifying and doggedly correcting inconsistencies that push a company away from its core ideology or impede progress. If the building layout impedes progress, change the building layout or move. If the strategy is misaligned with the core, change the strategy. If the organization structure inhibits progress, change the organization structure. If the incentive system rewards behavior inconsistent with the core, change the incentive system. Keep in mind, the only sacred cow in a visionary company is its core ideology. Anything else can be changed or eliminated. The end of the beginning. We feel a bit like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, who, after her long journey in search of the wizard, pulls back the curtain and discovers that the wizard isn't a wizard after all. He's just a normal human being. Like Dorothy, we discovered that those who build visionary companies are not necessarily more brilliant, more charismatic, more creative, more complex thinkers, more adept at coming up with great ideas, in short, more wizard-like than the rest of us. What they've done is within the conceptual grasp of every manager, CEO, and entrepreneur in the world. The builders of visionary companies tend to be simple, some might even say simplistic, in their approaches to business. Yet simple does not mean easy. We think this has profound implications for what you take away from this book. It means that no matter who you are, you can be a major contributor to building a visionary company. You don't have to wait for the great charismatic visionary to descend from the mount. You don't have to hope for the lightning bolt of creative inspiration to strike with the great idea. You don't have to accept the debilitating perspective, well, let's face it, our CEO just isn't a charismatic visionary leader. It's hopeless. You don't have to buy into the belief that building visionary companies is something mysterious that only other people do. It also means that life will probably be more difficult for you from here on out. It means helping those around you to understand the lessons of this book. It means accepting the frightening truth that you are probably as qualified as anyone else to help your organization become visionary. And it means recognizing that you can begin right now, today, to apply the lessons of this book. Finally, and perhaps most important of all, it means working with a deep and abiding respect for the corporation as an important social institution in its own right, an institution that requires the care and attention we give to our great universities or systems of government. For it is through the power of human organization, of individuals working together in common cause, that the bulk of the world's best work gets done.
Epilogue. Frequent questions. Question. I'm not CEO. What can I do with these findings? Let me respond first with a story. In 1976, 24-year-old Roger Briggs began teaching physics at a suburban public high school in Boulder, Colorado. As he settled into the rigors of a daily teaching routine, a persistent thought kept pushing itself to the front of his consciousness, a constant irritant like a pebble inside a shoe. Our schools could be so much better. Spending the next 30 years, the bulk of his productive life, mired in a system of mediocrity, struck Briggs as profoundly depressing. So he decided to do something about it. But what could he do? He wasn't principal of the school. He wasn't superintendent of the district. He wasn't governor of the state of Colorado. He had no interest in trying to become any of these things.
although later he would become chair of the science department. Roger Briggs wanted to remain right on the front line of education, shoulder to shoulder with fellow teachers working directly with kids. He decided to do whatever he could to make his little arena, the science department at Fairview High School, the best it could possibly be, to make it a pocket of greatness. I rejected the idea of being just a member of the worker class, acquiescing meekly to the systemic constraints that envelop schools, he said. I couldn't change the whole system, but I could make a big impact on our 14-person science department. It was almost like a moral obligation. I must try to make it better. Briggs wrestled with the question, what are the core values and fundamental purpose of this science department? What are we here to do? He wanted a department characterized by excellence in teaching, where magic happens when you get teachers in a room with motivated students. He also had in mind the equivalent of a BHAG, even though he didn't call it that. He wanted to turn his little science department into one of the very best, if not the best, at teaching science to public high school kids in the state of Colorado. He then began a long process of getting teachers in the department who would share this vision, creating a tight culture that would eject those that did not share the vision or who lacked the discipline to live up to the standards Briggs had in mind. Given low compensation society pays for public teachers and the paucity of rewards for performance, he realized that he had to fill science faculty seats with people compulsively driven to make whatever they touch the best it can be, not because of what they will get for it, but because they simply can't stop themselves from the almost neurotic need to improve. With a teachers' union that ensured a job security for the mediocre and the excellent alike, Briggs realized that it would be difficult to get the wrong people off the bus, so he decided to focus on getting the right people on the bus in the first place. He morphed the first 3 years of a teacher's career into an extended interview by inverting the 3-year tenure recommendation from a default of yes, if you haven't done anything terrible, you'll get tenure, to a default of no, unless you have proven that you can be an exceptional teacher, you will not get tenure. Each strong, positive hire had an effect on other people, which in turn increased the standards for new hires, which further increased commitment in the department. When administrators changed locks to increase building security, the science department lobbied to have them rekeyed so they could come into the office during off hours and weekends. As the culture tightened, wrong teachers increasingly felt themselves to be a virus surrounded by antibodies, and some simply self-ejected. Gradually, over the course of years, the science department culture changed. Hire by hire, recruitment by recruitment, self-ejection by self-ejection, until a critical mass of the right people coalesced into a pocket of greatness. Roger Briggs and the high school science department illustrate that you can create a pocket of greatness at nearly any span of responsibility on your own minibus, even in the face of significant structural constraints and limited resources. You don't have to be CEO to build a pocket of greatness. It can be done, and it is your responsibility to do it. Question: is it more risky to apply these findings to try to build greatness? Wouldn't it perhaps be safer to simply accept good? To be fair, our research would not capture companies that have visionary characteristics yet failed. This is what's known as the survivorship bias problem. Might it be that a higher percentage of companies that share visionary characteristics failed than those companies that do not share? To use an analogy, suppose we studied the climbing techniques of two groups of mountain climbers: visionary climbers, who successfully climb Mount Everest, and comparison climbers, who do not successfully climb Mount Everest. Further, suppose that we found differences between the two groups in philosophy, in training, in risk-taking, and so forth. It's entirely possible that the visionary climbers die more frequently than the comparison climbers. But since we're only studying climbers that lived, we wouldn't catch that fact in the study. So although we could give some excellent ideas as to what it takes to be a visionary climber, we might, unwittingly, also be giving guidance that increases the odds of death. Similarly, suppose having the characteristics of a visionary company results in 75% bankruptcy rate, allowing that 25% do go on to become super premier institutions. And having comparison characteristics results in only a 50% failure rate, allowing that the surviving 50% do not become super premium institutions. Under these circumstances, perhaps some would want to forgo being a visionary and increase the chances of simple survival. We have two responses to this concern. First, some climbers do indeed die while trying to climb Mount Everest, but only those who fully try to climb Mount Everest, whatever the risks, ever reach the summit. We cannot deny the possibility that some companies with visionary characteristics have died out there on the corporate landscape. But so what? We're not writing about mere survival in this book. We don't find mere survival to be a very interesting topic. We're interested in how companies might attain entrance to that special category of premier institutions, and we readily admit that it might require a risky path to get there. But, and this is our second response, we believe, although we cannot prove, that the visionary characteristics might actually increase both the odds of greatness and the odds of survival. We return again to our historical perspective. We're not writing about one-shot companies here. We're writing about enduring companies that have faced massive change and prospered for decades upon decades. If being visionary is risky, then why has this risk not caught up with these companies and killed them at some point during their very long lives? Question: do your findings apply outside of business, in the social sector? Well, let me answer that with a story. In 1976, Frances Hesselbein found herself at the center of an organization cascading toward irrelevance. Hesselbein became CEO of the Girl Scouts of America at the most perilous time in its then 64-year history. As John Byrne described in Business Week, a feature from which I have drawn extensively for this question, Hesselbein faced challenges at least as difficult as those faced by CEOs of decaying old-line corporations, declining market share, dissatisfied customers, economic weakness, and even hostile takeover threats. "Lurking in the background like a corporate raider," wrote Byrne, was the Boy Scouts of America, which had launched a feasibility study of extending its membership to girls. With 8 straight years of declining membership, the Girl Scouts were in danger of going the way of the Howard Johnson Motor Restaurants. The Girl Scouts organization of 1976 was predominantly white, yet eager to serve all girls. The girls of America were fast becoming aware of their diversity, their talents, and their ambitions. They worried less about preparing for marriage and more about preparing for college and work, less about household skills and more about how to respond to increasing peer pressure to have sex and take drugs. They wanted, needed, a highly contemporary organization that could help them become leaders in the world and responsible for their own lives. Hesselbein came into her responsibility as a consummate insider. With 25 years' experience, first as a volunteer troop leader and later as a local council executive director and a national board member. Dyed in green, the color of the Girl Scouts, Hesselbein vowed to defend the timeless core values of the Girl Scouts and recommitted to its enduring mission of helping girls reach their highest potential. Beyond that, however, everything else would be open for change. And change she wrought. Hesselbein believed that any girl in America, be she low income or wealthy, urban or rural, black, white, Latina, or whatever, should be able to picture herself in the Girl Scouts. If I'm a Navajo child on a reservation, a newly arrived Vietnamese child, or a young girl in rural Appalachia, I have to be able to open the Girl Scout handbook and find myself there, Hesselbein said. That's a very powerful message, that I'm not an outsider. I am part of something big. The Girl Scouts changed not only materials like the Girl Scout handbooks, even translating them into multiple languages, but also initiated a slew of new offerings. Proficiency badges sprouted up in topics like math, technology, and computer science to reinforce the fact that girls are, and should think of themselves as, smart, capable individuals. The organization artfully moved people to confront the brutal facts facing girls in modern America, such as teen pregnancy and alcohol use among minors, by creating materials on sensitive issues. The parent organization did not force these materials down people's throats, but simply gave the interdependent councils the opportunity to use the materials at their discretion. Most did. Hesselbein grasped the central paradox of change and progress, the key idea of built to last. The organizations that best adapt to a changing world first and foremost know what should not change. Had she marched in with a big change program full of herself as the great charismatic change leader, her efforts likely would have failed. Instead, she began with a rededication to the guiding core values and enduring purpose of the Girl Scouts as the framework for change, giving people an anchor point of stability. Preserve the core, stimulate progress. Yes, there would be change, but it would be done in the spirit of reinvigorating the soul of the institution, not destroying it. Equally important, she exercised the discipline to say no to changes and opportunities that did not fit the core values and purpose. When a charity organization sought to partner with the Girl Scouts, envisioning an army of smiling girls going door to door to canvass for the greater good, Hesselbein commended the desire to make a difference, but gave a polite and firm no. She pounded out a simple mantra. We are here for only one reason, to help a girl reach her highest potential. She steadfastly steered the Girl Scouts into those activities, and only those activities, where it could make a unique and significant contribution to its members. And throughout, she bolstered the financial health of the Girl Scouts, mindful of Peter Drucker's adage that the foundation for doing good is doing well. And indeed, the results came. Not just financial, for that is not the point in a mission-driven enterprise, but equally in terms of membership, volunteer dedication, and the enduring impact on the lives of girls. Under her leadership, the Girl Scouts regained its preeminent position, with a girl membership of 2.25 million and a workforce, mainly volunteers, of 780,000. Just as important, the organization had attained greater diversity and cohesion than at any time in its history, each side of the coin reinforcing the other in a powerful yin and yang combination. Preserve the core, stimulate progress. Finally, she set up the organization to be successful long into the future beyond her tenure to make it built to last. By 2002, the Girl Scouts of the USA had grown to nearly 4 million members, including nearly 1 million adult member volunteers. The story speaks for itself. If you take every key idea in Built to Last, Frances Hesselbein lived them in her rebuilding of the Girl Scouts to greatness. These are not business ideas. They are human ideas, applicable to nearly any type of human system, corporate or not. Question: do the Built to Last ideas apply at a personal or individual level, perhaps even to our personal lives? A significant number of people have reported to us that they've applied the yin and yang concept of preserve the core, stimulate progress to the fundamental human issues of self-identity and self-renewal. Who am I? What do I stand for? What is my purpose? How do I maintain my sense of self in this chaotic, unpredictable world? How do I infuse meaning into my life and work? How do I remain renewed, engaged, and stimulated? These questions challenge us at least as much today as ever before, perhaps more so. With the demise of the myth of job security, the accelerating pace of change, and the increasing ambiguity and complexity of our world, people who depend on external structures to provide continuity and stability run the very real risk of having their moorings ripped away. People cannot reliably predict where they are going and how their lives will unfold, especially in today's world. Those who built the visionary companies wisely understood it is better to understand who you are than where you are going, for where you are going will almost certainly change. It is a lesson as relevant to our individual lives as to aspiring companies. You can take the vision framework from Chapter 10 and apply it to yourself. What are your core values that will not change over your entire lifetime? What is your core purpose, your enduring reason for being? Why were you put here on this earth? What is your 25-year BHAG or 15-year BHAG, your big, hairy, audacious goal? What mechanisms are you building in your life to remain true to your core values and to drive you toward accomplishing your BHAGs? What are your priorities? What is misaligned and should be removed? As individuals, Jerry and I have both found it very helpful to articulate our own answers to these questions using the vision framework. Having a 15-year BHAG and a clear and consistent set of core values to guide behavior provides personal clarity in an ambiguous world. It is particularly powerful to then set top three priorities each year, consistent with the BHAG, in three categories. Every year, following from the BHAG, consistent with your core values and purpose, what are your top three opportunities to accomplish? What are your top three things to stop doing? And what are your top three supporting mechanisms to build? So again, every year, you should go back, revisit core values, core purpose, 15-year BHAG, and then set three sets of three priorities. The top three things you're going to get done this year, the top three things you're going to stop doing, and the top three mechanisms you are going to build. And then at the end of the year, with rigorous grading, assess your progress. Grade yourself on every single one of them. A, B, C, D, F. And where you don't get a high grade, autopsy Y. Then reset your new priorities for the coming year. Repeat every year for the rest of your life. Question: do the Built to Last findings guarantee greatness? We'd love to be able to say that if you just take our concepts and apply them with great rigor, you're guaranteed of great outcomes. We cannot say that for a couple of reasons. One, we do not have all the answers. There is more work to do, more research to conduct, more discoveries to make. Our research continued after Built to Last, and it continues today with new work underway. Each piece of research adds to our understanding, but we will never have all the answers. It is unlikely that in 20 years we will have to stand up and say, sorry, but preserve the core, stimulate progress turned out to be wrong. But we are certain to say our research frameworks were solid as far as they went, but they were incomplete. There is always more to learn. Second, there is certainly a correlation between our findings and the enduring great companies, but we cannot claim with certainty a causal link. We cannot prove that the characteristics of visionary companies will necessarily lead to enduring greatness in all cases. Our comparison analyses give us greater confidence that we have identified causes and not just random correlations. But outside of pure science, of controlled experiments that can be perfectly replicated, which is simply not possible in the social world, we cannot claim pure causation. No one in the social sciences can do that. Question: you studied the past. Do you worry that your findings might become obsolete in the 21st century? During the internet bubble of the late 1990s, I delivered a lecture on our research findings to a gathering of internet executives when a hand shot up in the back of the room. How do you respond to the idea that nothing from your research applies in this new economy? Asked the executive attached to it. He was challenging the whole idea of learning from the past. If this truly is a new economy, he wondered, don't we need to throw out all the old concepts and start from scratch? Well, yes and no. Yes, the specific methods of building companies in coming years will be dramatically different than in the past. But that does not mean we should toss aside the timeless principles that made companies great. What's the difference? Think of it like this. While the practices of engineering continually evolve, the laws of physics remain relatively fixed. Preserve the core and stimulate progress is a law of physics for building an enduring great company, as is the idea of being a clock builder, not just a time teller. The specific mechanisms, on the other hand, used to preserve the core and stimulate progress will almost certainly change. But the basic underlying concept will likely remain as important as ever. Consider the mechanism of a traditional job. Eventually, we're going to look back at single job employment structures, the way we put them together in the 20th century, as actually barbaric. We're going to look at traditional jobs in the future the way today we look back at indentured servitude. We will increasingly see a shift away from ownership of people in any form, including the traditional notion of a job, which, if you think about it, is nothing other than a more advanced form of owning people by owning their time. Every relationship, at least in the best organizations, will be viewed conceptually as a joint venture. This means that the central idea of holding people together with core values and shared goals will become even more important, not less so. Look at the trends of organization. Flatter, more decentralized, geographically dispersed, greater individual autonomy, more knowledge workers, and so on. More than at any time in the past, organizations will not be able to hold themselves together with the traditional methods of control, hierarchy and systems and budgets and all of that. Even going into the office will become less relevant as technology enables people to work from remote sites. The bonding glue that holds the system together will increasingly come in the form of shared values, purposes, and goals. The very stuff we've been discussing for the last 6 hours. People still have a fundamental human need to belong to something they can feel proud of. They have a fundamental need for guiding values and sense of purpose that gives their life and work a semblance of meaning. They have a fundamental need for connection with other people, sharing with them the common bond of beliefs and aspirations. More than any time in the past, people will demand operating autonomy while also demanding that the organizations they're connected to stand for something. And look at the trends in the outer world: fragmentation, segmentation, chaotic change, unpredictability, increased entrepreneurship, and so on. Only those companies particularly adept at stimulating progress will be able to thrive. Companies in search of greatness will need to relentlessly push themselves for self-stimulated change and improvement before the world demands change and improvement. More than ever before, companies will need to embrace the yin and yang dynamic of preserve the core and stimulate progress. The same holds for the principle of clock building. The concept of focusing on building the characteristics of the organization versus coming up with a great idea or being a great charismatic leader will become even more important. With the accelerating rate of technological change, increasing global competition, and dramatically shorter product life cycles, the lifespan of any specific idea will continue to decline. No matter how great the idea, it will become obsolete more quickly than at any time in the past. The specific mechanisms in the clock will need to be very different, but the mindset of building a clock versus just telling time will remain important for those who want to build an enduring great company.
Book copyright 1994-1997 by Jim C. Collins and Jerry I. Porras. Production and abridgment copyright 2004 by HarperCollins Publishers. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.